It's 6 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Steve Norman reporting. Germany is temporarily reinstating passport controls along its border with EU partner Austria to limit the flow of migrants and refugees. Speaking with VOA, Monash University EU politics expert Ben Welling explains what it means to have an EU nation close its borders.
Germany's borders are regulated by something called the Schengen Treaty, and this is a treaty from 1995 that essentially provides, you know, the borderless Europe that we know. So for the Germans to close their borders actually really imperils this fundamental treaty of European integration. And that's why this is, in one level, a surprise. And on the other hand, you know, dealing with hundreds of thousands of migrants, we might expect governments to try and seek to control this flow of people in some way.
More than 430,000 migrants seeking a better life, including refugees from Syria and Iraq, have made their way to Europe this year. Nearly 3,000 died crossing the Mediterranean Sea, according to the International Organization for Migration. Palestinians and Israeli police clashed at the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in Jerusalem Sunday on the eve of Rosh Hashanah, the Jewish New Year. Violence at the site has been escalating because Muslims are upset by non-Muslim visitors and a push to allow Jewish prayer in the compound outside of Al-Aqsa. Jews revere the site, as do Muslims. Suicide bombers killed at least 7 people Sunday in attacks in the northern Cameroonian town of Kolafata, a border area that has suffered numerous attacks from Nigerian-based Boko Haram insurgents. Cameroon, a major contributor to the multinational joint task force defeating the Sunni insurgency. This is VOA News. Both sides in the South Sudan conflict plan to attend a special meeting on that conflict and peace agreement implementation in New York on September 29th on the sidelines of the UN General Assembly session, the meeting at the invitation of Secretary General Ban Ki-moon. South Sudanese Foreign Minister Barnaba Mario Benjamin told VOA that Vice President James Wani Iga will lead the government's delegation. He says it should involve positive discussions, not to be about punishment and negativity. Following reports on ongoing fighting, the United States has been among a group of nations warning of sanctions that should last a month's peace agreement to end the nearly 2-year conflict not be fully implemented. Ambassador Ezekiel Lol Kathkuth, the Foreign Affairs Secretary for the rebels, expressed his hope that 3 items would be discussed.
The world supporting peace in South Sudan, mobilizing the world also to mobilize resources to reconstruct South Sudan, mobilizing the whole world also to help in resettlement of the IDPs and refugees in the neighboring countries and also internally inside the country.
He says rebel leader and former Vice President Riek Machar will lead the rebel delegation to those talks. 2 sides are engaged in security talks in Ethiopia this week. Taliban insurgents have stormed a prison in eastern Afghanistan, releasing hundreds of prisoners. Well-organized attack began with a suicide car bombing that allowed other rebels to get into the prison, according to Muhammad Ali Ahmadi, the deputy provincial governor for the eastern Ghazni province. At least 350 prisoners escaped during the chaos of that bombing, according to the Afghan Interior Ministry. Taliban has claimed responsibility for the attack. Powerful bomb went off in central Pakistan on Sunday evening, killing at least 10, injuring around 60 others. That violence happened near a bus terminal in the city of Multan, about 600 kilometers southwest of Islamabad. Hospital officials said several people were seriously wounded and feared the death toll could rise, no one claiming immediate responsibility. Serbia's Novak Djokovic has won the U.S. Open tennis tournament against Switzerland's Roger Federer. That game played in New York. It was the 10th Grand Slam tournament win for Djokovic and his 3rd this year after taking both the Australian Open and Wimbledon. Djokovic and Federer have dominated men's tennis during the past decade, along with Spain's Rafael Nadal. After Sunday's final, the last major of the year, the trio has now won 40 of the past 48 Grand Slams.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Bate in Washington. Today is Monday, September 14th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Nigeria's president visits France today, Monday.
The president will specifically be asking the French government to assist Nigeria in the areas of intelligence and equipment.
Femi Adesina is special advisor to Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari on media and publicity. About 40,000 people displaced by Boko Haram in the Lake Chad region are in dire need. How many African peacekeepers have been killed by Al-Shabaab in Somalia? We'll get explanation from AMISOM. Fatalities are difficult to find, and Boko Haram attacks in Cameroon killed 9 and 24 wounded.
Two young boys, aged between 15 to 17, they were the ones who triggered the bomb when they discovered that they were already identified as being members of Boko Haram.
Issa Chiroma Bakari is Cameroon's Minister of Communication, and it appears a controversy is brewing here in Washington about the visiting Liberia amputee soccer team. Those stories, plus Mark Ouma's Sports and our Listener of the Day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari begins a three-day visit to France today, Monday. Femi Adesina, special advisor to Mr. Buhari on media and publicity, says the visit is at the invitation of French President François Hollande and will focus on further strengthening bilateral cooperation between Nigeria and France in the areas of defense and security, trade and investments.
The president is responding to an invitation extended to him after the elections by President Hollande of France. Nigeria and France have been allies for a long while. You have plenty French companies doing business in Nigeria and vice versa. So it's an opportunity to strengthen the bonds of brotherliness.
Of course, this trip is coming at a time that your country, Nigeria, is involved in this fight against Boko Haram. Is this likely to come up in terms of possible French support for your country's effort to defeat Boko Haram?
Yes, it will come up, and the president will specifically be asking the French government to assist Nigeria in the areas of intelligence and equipment. Intelligence to use possibly towards recovering the abducted Chibok girls and to also win the war against insurgency conclusively. And then, of course, whatever equipment the French government can make available, Nigeria will also be quite glad to receive such.
So your country is still very intent and very serious about getting back those girls that were abducted, the Chibok girls.
As long as those girls are alive, Nigeria is determined to get them back. It's something that touches the heart of the president, that touches the heart of the administration. And in whatever way it lies in its power, the government will want to get these girls back.
France already has its supporting efforts in Mali, and I think France is also supporting its former colonies in the name of Chad. So do you think this would be a good thing for France also to help Nigeria?
Well, there's every indication that France will be well disposed towards helping Nigeria. Though Nigeria is not a French colony, there is every reason to believe that the French government is well disposed towards helping Nigeria. Particularly, the French government knows that if Nigeria is at peace, the whole of Africa is at peace, including former French colony.
On the trade side, is your country also interested in trade with France, particularly Nigerian oil?
I won't say specifically oil, but I know that the Nigerian president is going to meet with the business community in France. They will include French companies that do business in Nigeria. They will be meeting with President Buhari in Paris.
Femi Adesina is special advisor to Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari on media and publicity. He was speaking with me from the capital, Abuja. Cameroon's Minister of Communication and Government spokesman says Cameroon and the other countries of the region are fighting what he called an asymmetrical war against Boko Haram and its sympathizers. Issa Chiroman Bakari says this makes it difficult to fight the terrorist group successfully. This came as two bomb attacks on Sunday on the northern Cameroon town of Koulafata killed at least 9 people and wounded about 24. Bakari said the bombs were planted by 2 teenage boys between the ages of 15 and 17.
Unfortunately, this morning at the early hour of the day in Koulafata, which is the market day, 2 young boys aged between 15 to 17, they were the ones who triggered the bomb when they discovered that they were already identified as being member of Boko Haram. When the people wanted to arrest them, this is the moment they have chosen to trigger their bomb. But we were very much fortunate because thanks to the vigilance of a committee that population put in place, we avoided the catastrophe which might have taken place. Because what they wanted to do is to go to a marketplace and to detonate their bomb while they are within a group of people. Or if they fail to do it in a marketplace, to go in a church because today is Sunday. Thanks to the vigilance of our population, we avoided it and we owed it to the Lord. Unfortunately, 2 members of a committee of vigilance lost their lives in this event.
Mr. Minister, your country is one of the countries involved in the fight against Boko Haram. But it seems to me since you got deeply involved, do you feel that Boko Haram attacks are being diminished or have they increased?
Well, you see, we are fighting an asymmetric war against Boko Haram sympathizer and warrior. It is impossible to know who are they. That reason why it is always difficult to find them successfully. If we had to do with people who we can identify, localize them where they are before they enter into our country, it is easy to eradicate them. But unfortunately, this is not the case. If they want to attack, they are always with the population. Now their new strategy consists of using young girl or boy. This is their new strategy. And you can understand the reason why. It is always difficult, not to say impossible, to prevent this from taking place.
The town of Koulafata is near the Nigerian border. Does Boko Haram have bases in Cameroon, or are they coming from Nigeria?
It is impossible to settle in Cameroon because our population, the elite, the religious leaders, all of them are sufficiently sensitized so that it is impossible for them to settle in Cameroon. But they always come from Nigeria. They cross the border because it is not difficult to cross the border from Nigeria to Cameroon in this area. So they cross the border, enter into Cameroon, and operate the attack.
Issa Chiroma Bakari is Cameroon's Minister of Communication and Government spokesman. He was speaking with me from the capital, Yaoundé. During the past 2 months, more than 40,000 people have been displaced in the Lake Chad region due to Boko Haram-related violence, says Adele Sarkozy of the World Food Program. Sarkozy, who visited some of the 22 sites for the internally displaced between Bole and Bagassola in Chad, tells Ricky Shryak the situation of the displaced in these areas is critical.
In the past 2 months, they have an influx of IDPs, so people who have been living on the islands of Lake Chad region, and they've been attacked by Boko Haram, so they moved to the mainland. Just to give you an idea, so before June in Chad, we had something like 11,000 IDPs, so people who have been impacted by the Boko Haram crisis. And now, so since July, we have 41 new ones, so it's like 51,000 IDPs in total, but 41,000 of them have been displaced in the past 2 months.
Are people saying that the violence is getting worse around the area? What are people thinking is the cause of the influx?
It's basically the violence. So I've been speaking to a lot of women, and they were saying how they have had their husbands or their children being killed in front of them in sometimes, so they're very traumatized. They fled using the boats, the pirogues here. Some of them actually said they just jumped into the water and they were swimming to get to the mainland, and they were swimming for 3 to 6 hours to get to safety. And the conditions are very dire. I mean, there are staying on the sort of temporary IDP sites. There's about 22 of them on the mainland. They just mushroomed in the past 2 months and they got nothing. I mean, even the tents, they're just very flimsy. I don't know if I can even call them tents. They're just sort of like constructions made out of sort of sticks and covered with different sort of bits and pieces of plastic or fabric. People have been saying they have no food. The host communities have been very helpful, and I've spoken to women from the host communities, and one of them was saying how if I came 3 or 4 weeks ago, she would have been able to show me her crop. She had corn, and now she had nothing because she shared it with the people who have been displaced. So it's all sorts of, you know, people from all sorts of walks of life being affected, or traders in Bol where I was who were saying now they can't really sell their goods, their crops, because people have no money.
What is available to people right now besides the generosity of the people who are already there?
So they have very little to nothing because they are not getting help anymore from the host communities because their resources have been depleted as well. So they are in need of help as well. The people that I've spoken to, they said they received food from WFP a few weeks ago, but what they received, it's gone now, or they have very little left. We were able in August to help about 20,000 of the newly displaced, but as I mentioned, there is double, the number is double, so it's like 41,000 people, but we are not able to reach out to all of them because of lack of funding.
That was Adele Sarkozy, a spokesperson for World Food Programme for West and Central Africa. She was speaking to Ricky Shryak from N'Djamena, Chad. Today is Monday, September 14th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voices of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 17 minutes past the hour. The African Union mission in Somalia, known as AMISOM, has been the deadliest ever peacekeeping mission in Africa. Yet, the mission is coming under criticism, apparently, for withholding information from the public about its troop fatalities. Paul Williams is Associate Professor of International Affairs at George Washington University here in Washington. He is working on a book about the history and operational challenges of the African Union mission in Somalia. He explains why it has been difficult to get fatality figures from AMISOM.
It is very difficult to get exact figures on AMISOM's number of casualties, and there are a couple of reasons for that. I think the first one is that it's because AMISOM's troop-contributing countries have chosen to adopt a policy where they don't release their casualty figures publicly. And then secondly, we also face the problem that the war in Somalia is obviously very complex and complicated, and a lot of the battles and events that cause fatalities happen in remote parts of the country. And so this becomes very difficult for independent journalists and other analysts to verify the precise numbers of fatalities.
You try to calculate an estimate of troops who may have died while serving AMISOM mission in Somalia. Tell us your conclusion and how you came about to this conclusion.
Yeah, that's a good question again. So my overall conclusion is that I do not know the exact number of fatalities that have occurred in the African Union mission. So what I did in my article was try and pull together different sources of information. So I think in that sense, there were two main sources of estimates that I wanted people to know about. The first comes from the Stockholm Institute for Peace Research, and it says it's received information directly from the African Union mission itself to provide fatality estimates. And the conclusion they came to was that from the 1st of January 2009 up until the 31st of December 2014, that AMISOM had suffered an estimated 1,108 fatality. My own research then, which has been conducted with various people connected to the African Union mission over the last few years, suggests that an alternative source for thinking about fatalities is both the medical records from some of the hospital facilities that the mission has, and also, as we just talked about before, the financial records. And there, my estimates seem to be a bit different from those of SIPRI. But I think, broadly speaking, those are in the right sort of ballpark as far as we can tell.
Paul Williams is Associate Professor of International Affairs at George Washington University. He was speaking with Haroon Maruf of U.S. Somali Service. there's a controversy brewing here in Washington about the Liberia amputee soccer team, which came to the United States over a month ago. It appears the three-time African Nation tournament champions are stranded, and some say their current situation is their own making. According to members of the team, they had been invited by the United States Amputees Football Federation to take part in an international friendly match that was supposed to be held in the state of Maryland in early August this year. But before they could leave Liberia, the tournament had been canceled. Still, the team decided to come to the United States. Now it appears they are having a tough time in terms of meeting their basic daily needs. Cooper Melvin Gauthier is president of the Liberia Amputee Soccer Association. He says they came to the United States to explain to the world their situation and to appeal for assistance.
We received an invitation to come to America to attend a foundation tournament, also have a lecture at Morgan State University. But we knew that actually on the 23rd of June, the tournament was canceled, but we had other appointments. So that's how we used this opportunity to come to be America, and we came. And since we came, we've been meeting other friends, and we felt that back home things are difficult. So that's why, you know, we need to see how we can raise some funds, you know, for our own, you know, for our own organization and for our own purposes.
If a Liberian were to come here, sitting with us here, and say, well, Mr. Botti asked them, why did they come to the United States even though the tournament they were supposed to participate in had been canceled? Did they use that time just to come here and stay in the United States? What would you say to that Liberian?
What I would just tell the Liberian that would be saying such thing, because I will give him first of all a parable. I say, look, if you got a child and you born a child and you don't well taking care of the child, will the child be brave to be around you? The answer will be no. So pray tell me, and America is a place that when people, your baby say you're born, they say you are going to America tomorrow, they don't sleep. Then what more about us? And we being African, we need assistance. So that's why we decided to come to the tournament with cancer. Okay, we took this as an opportunity.
What is your plight? What is your situation in Liberia?
Well, in Liberia, Amputee Sports Association have won, you know, tournaments two, three times in succession, and we are not being honored. And for that, you know,
you won tournament three times.
Yes.
Which one, Liberian tournament or the African?
The African Nation tournament for amputee soccer.
Three-time champion.
Three-time champion. So we were not honored by the government, and we felt that we put our plug for the government that we need, you know, some housing facility for the amputee, you know, back, you know, amputee motor when you get in somebody's vehicle. The actually were crushed with script the car and other stuff. We need some education program for our children and even our very self. So that's, you know, when we got this opportunity to come to America, we said, wow, but it is an opportunity for us to go and let, you know, our voice be heard out there and express our, you know, our greed to international community and our brothers and sisters that in the diaspora to see how best they can come to our rescue, because back home it's not easy.
Do you have every intention to return to Liberia?
Yes. Liberia is our home. Provided if we, you know, sick in all this thing. And I can say, yeah, I wanted to go back, but when I heard information back from home telling that they are threatening me as leader with my co-worker, that because I allow government take money and use it, that they were not, you know, willing to use that money. So if I go back, they're going to persecute me. So for that reason, I'm a little bit afraid.
Cooper Melvin Gauthier is president of the Liberia Amputee Soccer Association. He spoke with me here in Washington, D.C. But Liberia's Minister of Youth and Sports says there's been a lot of goodwill towards the amputees, and the government encourages them to return home because it is better to loiter in Liberia than in America. Eugene Nambwe denies claim by the Liberia Amputee Soccer Association President Gauthier that the government plans to prosecute them for using government funds to travel to the United States to participate in a tournament that had already been canceled.
As you know very well, they left Liberia purportedly to attend a tournament organized by the American Amputee Association. Unfortunately, the American Amputee Association did not contact the government through the Ministry of Youth and Sports, nor the American Embassy. They wrote the Liberia Amputee Association directly, informing them that the march had been canceled several days before they left. Yet still, they hid the letter, canceling the march, and then they boarded the plane and left. So we have been encouraging them to come back home because the visa was granted for a particular purpose. The American Embassy here in Liberia has made representations to the Liberian government. A It's an embarrassing situation, but we understand that sometimes people think the pasture is greener on the other side, and that whichever way you enter America, you're going to have gold and diamonds. We have been encouraging them to come back home. We welcome them. They are our citizens. This government has a record, a good human rights record. So why would we threaten people, particularly people who are disabled and who are amongst the less fortunate in society?
In my talk with them, they told me that one of the reasons they came here, even though the trip had been canceled, was that, you know, they thought they could come to the United States to solicit support for themselves, because they claim that the Liberian government, even though they are three-time Africa champion, did not honor them. Most of their members live in some deplorable conditions. Sometimes they cannot find food. How much support is your government giving this group?
We have given massive support relative to our national budget, relative to what we give to even the National Lone Star. I mean, comparatively, they receive currently in the budget, the last budget that just passed, the national team received $300,000 and the amputee got $75,000. So if you look at the comparative analysis, we are doing more for a relatively small group of people. The president donated a bus to them that she encouraged local to give to them so they have transportation. We engage them daily. We fund their activities. We encourage sponsorship for their activities. One thing has happened, like I said earlier, is that some people want to use the advantage that they have, these particular individuals, that they are in America to say negative things. So with the hope that they could be allowed to stay. But it's a wrong way to behave. They deceived not just our government, not just the U.S. Embassy, but they also deceived the American Amputee Association.
Eugene Nambo is Liberia's Minister of Youth and Sports. He spoke with me from Monrovia. Time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. And here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Good Monday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with athletics. Tunisian Habiba Gribi clocked 9 minutes and 5.36 seconds in 3,000 meter steeplechase, and Kenyan Faith Chepngetich Kipyegon ran 4 minutes and 16.71 seconds in 1 mile as each set an Africa women's record at the IWF Diamond League in Brussels, Belgium on Friday. Botswana's Nigel Amos, Ethiopian Yomif Kejelcha, and Kenyan Virginia Nyambura won the Diamond League trophy in the men's 800 meters, 5,000 meters, and women's 3,000 meter steeplechase, respectively. The trophy represents the highest points accumulated in an event during the Diamond League series. In Italy, Burundi's Francine Nyonsaba won women's 800 meters in 1 minute and 57.62 seconds at the IWF World Challenge meet in Rieti on Sunday. Ethiopian Gudef Tsegay and Algerian Taufik Makloufi won women's and men's 1500 meters respectively. Moroccan Brahim Talib, Kenyan Hilary Mayo, and Jonathan Drake of Mauritius triumphed in 3000 meters steeplechase, 3000 meters, and triple jump respectively. In the Republic of Congo, Margaret Chelimo led Rosemary Wanjiru and Alisa Porote in a 1-2-3 Kenyan triumph in women's 5,000 meters at the All Africa Games in Brazzaville on Sunday. Clement Kemboi and Hilary Kemboi secured a 1-2 Kenyan victory in men's 3,000 meter steeplechase as Ethiopian Mamare Haile Mariam placed third. Cameroon's Jolie Mbumi won women's triple jump with Nigerian Ibrahim Blessing and Ghana's Nadia Eke second and third, respectively. South African Russell Tucker won men's discus. Eso Hunamundam Chalim was second in Togo national record of 52.72 meters, and Republic of Congo's Frank Elembe placed third. In football, Egyptian hosts Zamalek beat South Africa's Orlando Pirates 4-1 in Orange Africa Confederations Cup action in Cairo on Sunday. Republic of Congo's AC Leopards and Tunisia's CS Sfaxien drew 0-0. Egypt's El Ahly pipped Stade Malien 1-0, and in an all-Tunisian affair, Etoile du Sahel edged Esperance 2-1. Elsewhere, Algerian clubs Entente Setif and Mouloudia El Ulma drew 2-2 in Orange Africa Champions League action. Sudan's El Merrek pipped Algeria's USM Alger 1-0. Egypt's Esmouha and Sudan's El Hilal drew 1-1 as the Democratic Republic of Congo's TP Mazembe beat Morocco's Maghreb Tetouan 5-0. Finally, Algeria, Egypt, Mali, Nigeria, South Africa, Tunisia, Zambia, and hosts Senegal are set for the 2015 Africa Under 23 Cup of Nations draw in Cairo, Egypt today, Monday. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. And that's it for this Monday, September 14th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post editor Mark Ouma, along with our engineers Carl Sterling and James Harmon. I'm James Butte in Washington. Wishing all of you in Africa a very, very productive week.
Next on Let's Talk, nicknames. Do you like yours? Remember who gave it to you? Join host Sandy Shomari and his guests discussing nicknames. This lighthearted show covers topics of your interest with some hilarity. Let's Talk comes to you Mondays at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.